Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tom Waller. I'm chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled The Good Among the Great. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events which are held here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker. Donald Vandermark grew up in Toronto and Rhode Island and holds a BA in political science from Tufts University. During his 20 years as a correspondent and anchor for CNBC, CNN, and public television, Donald was intrigued with human success factors and profiled hundreds of entrepreneurs, corporate CEOs, and national political leaders with an eye to understanding the human qualities that contributed to their success. He then helped launch a San Francisco-based media company devoted to personal and professional development, which has evolved into SuccessTelevision.com. Donald is currently writing four short books, the first of which will be Personality Traits of the Most Successful Human Beings. Donald lives in Sonoma, where in addition to speaking and writing, he sells premier real estate in wine country. And as you might suspect, he's been at or near the top in terms of agent sales volume in recent years. So please join me in welcoming Donald Vandermark.
Thank you very much, Tom. I appreciate it. I want to thank all of you for coming out on a July evening. We're here to talk about ideas, but specifically about attitudes and behaviors of some of the most successful people in the world. And I really want to talk about a subset of these very, very high achievers. When I started interviewing a lot of business leaders and politicians 20 years ago, I was struck by a couple of them as I went along the way. The first one was a man named John Medlin, who was head of Wachovia Bank at the time. And I left his CEO's office, I think he was the chairman at the time as well, thinking to myself, this is an honest-to-goodness gentleman. His staff loved him. His bank was performing very, very well. He had had a long career in that bank and institution, and everyone in his industry thought he was a great and admirable character. And I thought, well, that's interesting. You don't have to be so tough, so ruthless, so determined that you put off people to be a big success. Well, over the years, every once in a while, I would come across another person like that. And when I got out to California and started working for this little company, My Prime Time, which is now SuccessTelevision.com, I came across a lot of these characters because I was interviewing entrepreneurs. And entrepreneurs are a special subset in the world of business. They are, by nature, a little bit of mavericks. They care more about money, or more than about money, excuse me. The finance people tend to be the ones very focused on money. The CEOs tend to be focused on power and money. And the entrepreneurs are very, very interested in making the world a better place, usually, or just building a better mousetrap, as they say. So that group started saying things to me, at least I thought I was hearing echoes as I interviewed them. Some of the same attitudes, some of the same behaviors, a lot of the same phrases, a lot of the same circumstances that they seem to make their way through in life. So it was a bit of a pattern recognition experiment, and I thought to myself, there is maybe a list of character traits or personality traits. And I was with this business that was doing personal and professional development for the middle-aged group. It was called My Prime Time, and that's a time in people's lives, at least for most of us, where we reflect a little bit more, and we think more about what our life is all about and prioritize our goals, and our motivations tend to shift. Anyway, I realized then that there was an academic underpinning to extraordinary psychological health. A gentleman named Abraham Maslow was a 20th century psychologist. How many of you have heard of Abraham Maslow? So virtually all of you. Now, what you've heard about him is that the hierarchy of needs, that human beings need to have or meet certain needs, such as food, shelter, certain amount of security, then a certain amount of esteem bestowed by parents and people around them. What you don't know is that he went further than that. He didn't ever do really rich data research on extraordinarily healthy human beings, but he started to. And he had a lot of what something Albert Einstein would call maybe a mind experiment. He came up with a list of traits and spread across a variety of books and essays. He outlined 19 different traits that I can find. And they're fascinating. And when I read the traits, I realized that the individuals that I was interviewing who were extraordinary achievers and extraordinarily well-liked, well-respected, admired individuals, there was the traits. I would think to myself, oh, there's Andy Grove, co-founder of Intel. There's Bill Bradley, the senator from New Jersey. There's a woman named Anne Bancroft and a woman named Liv Arneson, not the Anne Bancroft, the actress, but Anne Bancroft, who is a middle-aged school teacher in Minnesota who is a polar explorer. A very, very powerful but quiet, extraordinary human being, like a lioness among the rest of us. And I thought, well, there's something here, and I've wanted to write a book about it. And what I've found as a great exercise in writing the book is to give these speeches because it helps me focus, and I get feedback from people like you as to whether or not you think these things are valuable. These are the three traits I'm going to focus on tonight. There are 19. I'll show you the 19 on the screens. It's too much information. It's too much information for 6 hours. It's probably too much information for a book. I have a book publisher who keeps telling me, distill it, there's too much, distill it, too much. I'm going to show you the 19 anyway because I want to pay homage to Maslow. They're his ideas, and this is the academic underpinnings, which I think he deserves credit for. Anyway, these are the three we're going to look at. The first one seems very obvious. Most people, when I say this one, this is maybe the first one, the most important one, they get that. The second one is a little more subtle. Most of us are focused on me, ourselves, unmet needs. Neurotics are people who act out in ways because they have unmet needs. The average person of average health who's not really a neurotic, they still have these issues that they're still trying to get over. The last one, the acceptance of self, is more subtle. And this is the one that the really wonderful people have and the super high achievers typically don't. The first two, the super high achievers have. The third one, the really good people among the great also have. Here's Maslow. Born in the New York area, lived only to be about 60 years old, died in 1970 of a heart attack. And a lot of his thinking was picked up by various groups and sort of twisted and turned, and then he was forgotten. He was sort of relegated sort of to third-tier status among the great psychologists. Here's 19 traits. And I can hold this up after the speech if any of you want to write them down. Some of them are maybe of less importance, but they feed in. These all feed into each other. For instance, number 5, more openness to experience. Don't we all know people who do the same things every year? I have a brother who sits in the same chair whenever we get together for family. He lives in a house about 12 blocks from where we grew up. He's been in the same profession his entire career. He's only had 2 different jobs. He's stuck. Very, very capable, healthy people always want new things, new restaurants, new foods, new places to travel. They love meeting new people. And there's many reasons for it. It shakes up the thinking. It grounds them more in what's going on because everything is changing always. A lot of very famous people don't qualify to be very healthy because look at number 8. Very, very healthy people among famous people are really there despite the fame or in spite of the fame. They don't really want it, but they feel duty-bound because they're particularly strong people and they feel a responsibility to the planet, to the world, to their community. Number 11, increased spontaneity, expressiveness, full functioning. This is also a derivative of one that was on the first page, I think, which was integrated, fully integrated character. Integrated and integrity have come from the same root. These people are the same virtually to everyone, and therefore they're less guarded. They're not pretending to be someone to their spouse and someone else to the people they employ and someone else to their boss. I have friends I grew up with in Canada, and I'll talk more about them later. This is a very important subject to me, not just because it's intriguing from an academic standpoint or from a news or business or interviewing standpoint. I grew up around several families. It's a cohort of extraordinary healthy people, psychologically. And those people are just unguarded, spontaneous. They have so much fun all the time. I got a call the other day from a friend of mine I grew up with. She was my best friend's younger sister. And everything I said into the phone I thought might be a disappointment. She thought it was all great news. So I'm going home to Canada in 2 weeks, and it is an infusion. It's like a blood transfusion, but it's like a psychological fuel pump into my soul and spirit, because these people are so great and encouraging and full of love and life. Okay, let's go to the first one. This is the big one in terms of success. If you're here and you don't care about the softer stuff or really being happy and you just want to make money or power or fame, as Roger Ailes once asked me, this is what Maslow said: more apt to perceive what is there rather than their own wishes, hopes, fears, anxieties, their own theories and beliefs, or those of their cultural group. Maslow is focusing on the specific issue of skewed thinking, of your needs, of your background, of your fears and foibles, interfering with the way you see the world. We see it all the time. I see it in real estate. Every seller thinks their property is worth more than it is. Every buyer thinks the world is coming to an end at the moment and real estate prices should be a lot less. Everyone thinks their kid is above average. The whole country thought that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and a majority of the country still believed it after it was disproved. Skewed thinking interferes all the time with your perception of reality and therefore how you make decisions, whether or not you succeed. This is the Oxford Dictionary. They have four definitions, mind you, of reality. Always use Oxford, it's my opinion. And get the big one, the two-volume one at least, because there you get an etymology. And when you see how different words evolved in meaning, you get a much richer idea of the meaning of a word. So, Oxford Dictionary: the state of things as they actually exist, as opposed to an idealistic or notional idea of them. So their first definition touches upon this issue of the human failing in terms of grappling or having a proper perception of what's going on. This is not a debate about physical facts or existence, which is where philosophers often get bogged down. It is a recognition of our limitations, our biases, hopes, fears. Now, it's not just Maslow who focuses on this issue. M. Scott Peck, who wrote The Road Less Traveled, it's one of the best-selling books of all time. This is what he said about it: mental health is an ongoing process of dedication to reality at all costs. I don't know if you could say that in a more emphatic way. Now, very, very healthy people, and even very, very successful people, though not as much, they examine themselves, their foibles, their faults, their fears, their failings. Obama, I remember Barack Obama, when he hired David Axelrod, or he hired his team, more than one of them have said, that Barack Obama came to them and said, I can't do this. I can do this. I can make a great speech. I know what policies I think are best for America. I can stand the heat and the rigors of a long campaign, but I can't organize websites and email campaigns and the organizational aspects of it. So even someone as talented and as capable as he is constantly gauging and cataloging their own capabilities. Maslow: this superiority in the perception of reality eventuates in a superior ability to reason, to perceive the truth, to come to conclusions, to be logical, to be cognitively efficient in general, an unusual ability to detect the spurious, the fake, and the dishonest in personality. I have a friend. These are three friends. Damien is my partner, just bending over. And then these two women are dear friends. The one in the foreground was my first girlfriend. As kids, we grew up together. She's a marvelous, marvelous person, and her husband is a very successful businessman, and he says of her, quote, she can spot a fraud a block away, close quote. We were talking about another subject. We were talking about how he hires top-flight MBAs, quant jocks, and others for his financial firm. And I said, don't you wish you could hire someone like your wife? And he said, oh, if only I could. And one of the qualities that he then enunciated was she can spot a fraud a block away. And bing, in my mind goes, there's Maslow again. And this is a marvelous person who devotes herself to everyone else. She is outwardly focused. She is problem focused. She is not self-focused. Back to reality. Charlie Munger, how many people of you know who Charlie Munger is? Okay, about a third of you. Charlie Munger is the vice chairman of Berkshire Hathaway Corporation, which is arguably now the most successful corporation in America in many ways. This is Warren Buffett's sidekick. He's the grumpy old guy with the thick glasses who sits at those annual meetings and barks out one-word answers after Warren gives a very humorous and articulate answer to complex financial and human nature questions. Charlie Munger was asked once, if there was one reason, factor, in you and Warren's approach to how you do business that you could impart to the world, what would it be? Long pause. Grumbling. Finally, he spat out the word rational. They see the world for what it is. Now, rational. What is rational is actual. What is actual is rational. That's from Hegel, the philosopher, the German philosopher. Munger, recognize reality even when you don't like it. This is in his book, one of his favorite expressions, especially when you don't like it. And Munger devotes himself to biographies, particularly of scientists, and scientists because of the scientific method, double-blind studies, accurate measurement of results, really trying to find out what is there, what works. And Richard Feynman is a famous physicist. Never fool yourself. Remember, you are the easiest person to fool. That's why it's important to have people around you who are willing to tell you the truth, and you should be willing to listen to it. Most of us, that's very hard work. Okay, now, how do we get there? That's great. These people are wonderful. They see reality much better than we do. They understand themselves much better than we do. They're outwardly focused instead of focused on themselves. They're open to experience, so they're constantly testing their own judgments and assumptions. First thing you do is learn to shut up. It's hard for me to even say. My mother hated the term. But the issue is being quiet. I learned as an interviewer at CNBC, CNN, and now for Success Television, that the first thing you do is be quiet. And people can't stand the void. They can't stand the silence. Too often, even our most professional interviewers ask questions, they'll get an answer which actually has the seed or the nugget of something really fascinating, something very, very different, maybe something very new and personal from a famous person. And instead of listening and hearing and going with that, they ask the next question on their stupid list. It enrages me in my car when I'm listening to radio programs that way. I've interviewed more than one people where in the middle of the interview, the interviewee looks up at me and goes, this isn't why you came to interview me. And I said, no, but it's your interview. A woman named Marlene McDaniel, who was running women.com back in the early .com days, she started talking about how she gathers ideas. She said, you know, every night when I go home, I turn the radio off in the car, I turn my phone off, and I really just listen, if you will. And I said, for what? She goes, well, I gather ideas. I really believe that ideas are in the ether, that ideas are created socially, that we're all moving forward together, and that way I can gather those ideas out of the ether. I said, you're a scientific woman. Do you really believe that? And at that point she said, wait a minute, this isn't why you were here. I said, no, but... So you never know what will come out of someone's mouth, and you never know what you will learn. You know your own opinions. Who's the modern-day comedian who wrote, we don't listen anymore, we just wait to speak? So that's the first tip. Okay, new information, new experiences. I want to tell the next person we're going to talk about, very famous business person who's an expert on this. His name is Andy Grove. He's the co-founder, former chairman, former CEO of Intel, which is the dominant computer chip microprocessor company in the world. And when I asked him about this subject, you half expect him to this pushback. Guarded, unhealthy leaders don't want to talk about themselves or their psyches. They call it armchair psychology, and they find it invasive because they're usually hiding something. The healthy ones smile, open right up. This is what fascinates them as well, because this, they know, is their route to success in whatever business they're in, even if it's sports, something like that. So, Andy Grove on active listening.
You have to immerse yourself like a sponge into the environment, into and make yourself available to be influenced by people who want to influence you, who need to influence you. So each of these decisions properly has to be preceded by a period of absorption, listening if you wish.
You may remember in the 1980s, Intel was making very simple memory chips. And the Japanese, who are expert manufacturers for a variety of reasons, it's in their culture, they are just efficiency-minded, and Intel was in trouble. And Andy Grove bet the ranch, bet the company, on the future of something that no one really believed at that point would happen, which is that everyone in the world someday would have a personal computer. But he made himself available to the engineers within Intel. He did experiments in the marketplace. He notice how he said, make yourself available to the people who need to reach you. We're all surrounded by individuals who see what's going on, how we're thinking or behaving, how the world is going, how maybe we're missing a bit of information, how our approach right now is not working, used to work, doesn't work. And they need to reach us, particularly in big organizations. So you have to be more open-minded. You have to work down in the organization, up in the organization. You have to be willing to hear news, good, bad, and stuff that challenges your assumptions. Most of us don't like that. It's uncomfortable. We think it makes us unbalanced. He's looking for that. He bet the company on it, and of course, Intel has been a huge powerhouse since then. I had a friend who now works for Prince Charles. He's a major fundraiser. Before that, Margaret Thatcher, and before that, Ronald Reagan, to help him do his library. He's a very, very smart guy. And he used to bark at me, be a well, not a fountain. Just tuck that one into your mind. Observe, pay particular attention to events that challenge your assumptions and people who want and need to influence you. Remember this, everything is changing always. So your assumptions, your paradigm, the way you look at the world, you may be the smartest, most settled, most healthy, most capable person at the moment, and tomorrow, next week, certainly next year. All of that, not all of it, but a big portion of your approach won't work anymore. Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett challenge one of their most cherished assumptions every year. The worst, one of the worst investments you could make for over 150 years was railroads. Charlie and Warren invested big in railroads about 3 years ago because the world had changed. Because all of a sudden, railroads were the efficient form of transportation for industrial goods, for coal, for steel. Charlie Munger at his annual meeting this past April, Wesco, there's a division of Berkshire Hathaway in a way. It's also publicly traded that he is chairman of himself. So he has his own annual meeting. If you want to go sit at the feet of a master of human nature for 3 or 4 hours, go to that meeting. The meeting that Warren and Charlie do in Nebraska is now such a zoo, 60,000 people, that it's just not as good. Charlie said, when I was finishing at my law firm, I made a point of firing at least one client every year, just on moral grounds.
Participate in...
Whoops. Okay. We're now going to talk about another major leader in the world of technology. We're first going to hear from his brother. That gentleman you just saw for a split second is a man named Dan Case. Unfortunately, he's now deceased. Not long after this interview, he discovered he had a brain tumor. And he was head of... I want to say Chase H&Q. I mean, the investment banks here changed names as they got swallowed up by bigger and bigger banks, so I'm always tripping over exactly where he was. But okay, so it was Hambrecht and Quist and J.P. Morgan at that time. Okay. I don't think it's important, and certainly not to this speech, but it's hard to keep track of all that. Anyway, a very good guy. And when I started asking about his brother, Steve Case, because I was profiling him, and asking sort of those tender personal questions about childhood and psychological development and how Steve Case thinks, you're on risky ground. He opened right up, got it right immediately. Steve Case had a nickname at AOL that most people don't know about called The Wall. He would sit in meetings, large and small, interviews with people, and there would be this blank expression on his face. No one could read him. It was unnerving to people. And the reason was that he was observing as much as participating. When I asked Dan Case, I said, what is this whole thing about the wall? What is that all about? Was that anything in your childhood? Did he do that? And Dan Case said, oh, yeah. Steve was always an expert at participating and watching. This is what he had to say.
Participate and watch. Steve was always very good at participating and watching. I think maybe that's why this interactive medium, which is so personal, but in its early experiences less personal, was something he so innately understood.
So think about it. This is kind of a hyper-awareness. This is someone who's involved, trying things, experiencing new things. And when they were kids, they had their own little entrepreneurial businesses. They had paper routes, and then they tried to sell magazines, and then they tried to sell other stuff to the paper route recipients. And then in college, Steve Case managed a band, and he was always doing things, but he always was watching at the same time. This whole issue that Andy Grove was talking about, an alertness, putting oneself, ego aside, and watching. So when I went out to AOL and interviewed Steve Case, and I thought, oh, I'm going to get pushback, maybe, maybe not. He warmed right up to the subject.
Sort of being able to soak things up, just sort of, it's almost like a pattern recognition kind of experiment. Just hearing this, reading this, seeing that, thinking that, being able to kind of connect the dots in your own mind, even though maybe they're not so easily connectable. And that is kind of having a pulse to what's happening.
This is what Maslow had to say about it. These very alert, very aware, very observant people are like the child in the fable who saw that the emperor had no clothes on. These people can see the fresh, the raw, the concrete. They live far more in the real world of nature than the verbalized world of concepts, abstractions, expectations, beliefs, and stereotypes that most people confuse with the real world. One quick note on this subject, and that is wild animals, free creatures, are very, very alert because survival depends upon it. And so just as Maslow's pointing out that little children who don't have a lot of built-up biases, they don't have philosophical paradigms in which they live and they think they understand everything, they see things in a fresh way. Wild animals are sensory dominated. They always see everything in a fresh way because if they don't, they won't last long. Okay, so here's some tips, if you will, reality recognition tips. Develop listening awareness or even think of them as absorption skills. Don't make snap judgments. Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, was about the power of intuitive thinking, which is true, but the flip side of that book, and most people forget, is that it can trip you up. You also have to use your analytical skills to test what you've just gotten intuitively. Resist categorization. This is the root of so many evil isms, racism, sexism, etc. So when you see someone, they're dressed a certain way or they're a certain age, they whatever, and you start putting them into categories, it's very natural. It's the human psyche trying to make sense out of too much data. Assess like a pollster. There's a pollster in this room. And he knows very well that you don't pay attention much to a reaction until it reaches a certain what's the word? Tipping point, or it, you know, you don't pay attention unless you hear it over and over again. The old joke is if someone calls you an ass, you can brush it off. If a second person calls you an ass, you better stop and think about it. And guess what? If a third person calls you an ass, you are an ass. Argue using data, don't argue with the data. That's from Andy Grove. Trust your own analysis. Always do your own analysis. That's one of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger's great lessons about investing. You're going to hear all sorts of analysis from Wall Street. They have their own motivations. If you can't do your own, find someone who will. Seek reality checks constantly from those you admire. And this is a big one. This is proof is in the proceeds, not the pudding or the tasting of the pudding. The proof of your perception of reality and how good you are at it is going to come out in the success of your life. How well you're doing in your work, how well you're doing in your relationships, how well are you doing, how happy are you? Are you achieving your goals? If you're not, there very well could be something wrong with the way you see the world. This is what Dr. Phil and his show, you know, the summation question after the person explains how awful their family situation is, but this is the way they handle it. And he looks at them and goes, "So how's that working for you?" Trait number two. I don't have as much time as I want. This is the outward focus that generates a sense of responsibility as well as empathy for all humanity. They're not self-focused. They are problem-focused. Maslow said, problem-centered, they're concerned with the good of mankind or a few close individuals. CEOs, government leaders, but these are also people who are leaders in their community or they lead their family. This is a woman. She's a cousin of mine, a step cousin. She's a pediatric nurse. She's a published author. She's interested in holistic medicine as well as traditional medicine. That's her husband. She and he regularly get on a plane and go to a third world country and go to work in an orphanage or a hospital for several weeks a year because financially they're capable enough to do it. They have the skills and it turns them on. They love it. She is an angel. She is someone who resists small talk. She's very funny and lighthearted, but she wants to know exactly what's going on in your heart. She is someone who's not a CEO or a famous leader of any kind, but she is a wonderful person and extraordinarily outwardly focused. All right. If we talk about someone who's much more recognizable, we can talk about a major CEO, the man who was dubbed the CEO of the century by Business Week magazine, which is Jack Welch. I've interviewed Jack three times. He was made CEO of GE at the age of 45, enormous responsibility at a relatively young age. He revolutionized GE when he didn't have to. General Electric at that time, this is 1980, I think it is, or late 70s, and it was doing just fine. But he thought it could do much, much better. He trusted his own analysis, and he certainly wasn't going to rest on his laurels. He revolutionized the company and all of American business.
The initiatives he has launched or popularized, being number one or two in a market, globalization, a boundaryless corporate culture, rigorous statistical quality controls, service what you build, digitize everything. These are all business school staples. Yet Welch's genius is not just organizational. It is emotional, motivational.
When your job as a leader is to go around with a pump and pump self-confidence into people so they can be the best they can be. When we talk to a manager at a level four levels down or three levels down, we tell them, that's your job. Your job is to make everybody feel 6 feet tall with hair.
This from a man who's about 5'6", very bald. But Jack Welch was a leader even when he was a kid. I interviewed some of his best chums in Massachusetts. One of them is a state Supreme Court judge. And they tell story after story about how Jack Welch was always leading them, take charge, confident. And how did he get that way? I mean, yes, maybe some of it's DNA. But his mother was an endless encourager of him and also someone demanding more. I found the healthiest families who are healthy generation after generation are endlessly encouraging to their kids. Children don't have a wall. They don't have a psychological shell which protects their egos. So this stuff is particularly important for children. So if you have children or grandchildren, nieces, nephews, whatever, this stuff is very, very important for them. Now, taking on great responsibility, the way that Jack Welch did at 45 or that how leaders do, is not all smiles and Maslow academic research. It's tough. One of the ways that responsible leaders lead or succeed is that they have a level of ruthlessness. And Maslow will tell you that these extraordinarily healthy characters are so temperamentally strong that sometimes they appear ruthless. Because if they have a friend, for instance, who they discover has been treacherous or betrayed them in some way, they will drop them like a stone. A better analogy is I had a step-grandmother who was married for many, many years, loved her husband dearly. He passed away, and a week later, she was out on the town having a ball. You thought she'd be grieving or heartbroken or she couldn't stand the fact that he was gone. No. Completely independent, autonomous person who loved this man dearly but did not depend on him for her happiness. These are very, very strong people. Now, Welch takes it a step further. He had a policy at GE that you would reward the top 20%. There was the middle 70%. The bottom 10% was fired every year. He called it differentiation. One of his reasons was for the people who are in the corporation that you're leading, you're taking care of them. Take care of the ones who really are succeeding. And also the ones who aren't, there's probably very good reason for it, and they should be elsewhere. They should have another career. You shouldn't let them coast year after year, and then they may get to an age where they can't recover. So he was reality-based, focused on people, and ruthless when it came to execution. This is how he described it.
How can you have differentiation, top 20, middle 70, and throw out the bottom 10, and have teamwork? Teams do that every day. A 20-game winner, a 50-home run hitter, they get more money than the other players on the team, and the bottom 10 get traded or thrown out, and yet they're still a team. That's what business is.
In some ways, that's what life is. I think a very good thing to teach all kids and to recognize as an adult that the world is a very competitive place. And you may not always want to compete and you don't always have to compete. But in most walks of life, financially and career-wise and otherwise, you are going to be competing. So how do we become better competitors? One of the ways we do it is we become emotionally prepared. Very, very strong people use a variety of tricks to make themselves get through particularly tough times. You're now going to hear from the two women who traversed 1,700 miles on skis, dragging sleds across the coldest, driest, windiest place on the planet. These are two capable women. And this is Liv Arneson and Anne Bancroft talking about dealing with challenges and fear.
When I was on my own, I almost fell into a crevasse and my heart jumped and I almost panicked. I couldn't start thinking if I went another meter down there, I'd become locked in the crevasse. I was starting to think about the vacation and I and the kids had in the last summer, making pictures, forcing myself to think about other things than that deep crevasse. Because I think it's very easy for that you can yourself ruin your tour or your expedition by being caught in negative or terrible thoughts. So then I know I can force myself to other places mentally.
Both women say sustaining their own morale is probably the most important factor in staying on track. Going other places mentally is just one trick they use to quash panic, self-doubt, depression.
When people go down and feel, get bummed out on these trips, that's what the last trip taught me.
Okay. The next person I want to talk about is Andy Grove again. Andy Grove, besides discovering the impurity in silicon, sodium, which revolutionized or gave birth to the microprocessor age. He was an 8-year-old boy when the Nazis swept into Hungary. His father was marched off to a work camp. He and his mother, rather than waiting in Budapest for the roundup, they made a decision to flee. He took on a Gentile-sounding name, and they moved out into the country. He was fearful not only for his own life, but if he mistakenly answered to his own name in a schoolyard or in public, he knew that it could cost his mother her life. When he was 20 years old, and Eastern Europe was beginning to push back against Soviet domination, he and three friends headed west to the Austrian border. And there were dogs, and there were patrol cars, and there was a smuggler, and they finally made it on a cold December night in the rain, climbing through trenches and whatnot. And he wrote a book called Only the Paranoid Survive. So he's very, very aware of risk. This is what Andy Grove had to say about the issue of handling the stresses and anxieties of taking on leadership, of taking on more responsibility.
You sometimes have to act more confident than you really are. And that's not a normal way of operating, but when you kind of lost, the leader has to take certain personal risks.
And fake it in a way.
Stretch it beyond what you feel comfortable with. Faking it is too strong. You really have to believe in that direction, or else you won't be able to lead people in that way. But you may have to act more decisive than you really feel like.
What do you make of risk and danger, since you've made your way through a variety of types of risk and danger?
Well, you know, one thing that comes to mind is that there's a risk associated with taking action, and people are very mindful of that. But for every action that has a risk associated with it, there is a countervailing risk associated with not taking that action. And very often people look at the risk associated with the action and not consider that the default of not taking that action may be actually even higher risk.
This is the best tip I have gotten in a long time about success, succeeding. More important than the will to win is the will to prepare. I was a mediocre athlete in high school and college, and it was all about will. Charlie Munger is telling you it is more about preparation, and he's right. Thomas Jefferson's quotes, "Opportunity comes to the prepared mind. The harder I work, the more luck I have." Okay, tips. Start small and prepare. Communicate your concerns. That was one of the lessons from the two women who traversed Antarctica. You may have to act more courageous than you actually feel. Empathy coupled with courage is contagious. Think of Gandhi in South Africa as a young man tearing up his race card, identity card, being beaten as he put it into the burning inferno. And then the whole Indian community, black community, rallied behind him. And the last thing is something that Abraham Lincoln did, who was in a very overwhelming job, as you know, as president. He indulged in diversions, stories, jokes, going to the theater. Okay, last one, and I'm going to speed through this because we're almost out of time. This is the one: self-accepting, confident, independent, and autonomous. These individuals know who they are. First person I want to talk about is Bill Bradley. He was a senator from New Jersey. Before that, he was a major NBA star. He took Princeton to the NCAA finals and won it, and Ivy League schools don't win that tournament. He believes in self-direction. You are the master of your fate. All of these people believe that. This is what he had to say about this trait.
I've always felt that the external should reflect the internal, so where you are, where you live, how you feel, and that feeling has as much value as thinking. And I changed over the years. I probably was more of a thinking person for many years. But at the same time, I always had that experience when I was young of doing what I felt was truest to my person, which was playing basketball.
How strange and how wonderful to hear that feeling is as important as thinking. This is the one I have the hardest time with. I live in my brain in the world of ideas, too analytical, too cerebral. I don't pay enough attention to feelings. I like artists for that reason. They dwell in the world of feelings. So, from a guy who's very successful, he's telling you that your life success depends on that. So for all of you overachievers, wake up. Now, here's a funny thing about feeling as much as thinking. Very, very healthy people psychologically, Maslow will tell you, are excellent animals. They're hearty in their appetites, enjoying themselves without regret or shame or apology, are inclined to accept the work of nature rather than to argue with it. This shows itself in a relative lack of the disgusts and aversions seen in average people, such as food annoyances, disgust with body products, body odors, and body functions. When I read this, I thought of all of my pals up in a summer place in Canada, and they have huge appetites for food, for competition. They're great sleepers. They have no shame about sex. I remember being a kid, and my household was all clammed up about that stuff. It was verboten to talk about those issues. My parents were very conservative. This household, this one gentleman, Sandy McAfee, who's now in his robust 80s, with glee passed around an article from a medical journal about how important it was to push out gas as loudly and as enjoyably as you could. And many a shocked matron looked at him like he was crazy. And I just thought I was 15 or 16 at the time. I thought it was the greatest thing in the world. And it fascinated me that he had no qualms about it at all. Okay, to better understand yourself, to be more autonomous, to be more self-directed, tips: pay attention to your daydreams. Where does your mind go when you give it a chance to rest? Listen to your heart. When I retreated to Sonoma 9 years ago and was trying to figure out whether or not I'd go back to the East Coast, go back on television or not, I was figuring out what I would do. And the career path was one that I was going to be very much on my own. I was going to stay home and write. I might get my real estate license, do a little bit of that. And I had this anxiety-driven question pop into my head, which is, God, why are you retreating from the world? Why do you have to do everything on your own? And this answer that I still don't know where it came from was, what's wrong with being on your own? And I literally looked around, and I was on a lonely road with wind blowing through the trees. And to this day, I still think that maybe the trees were answering me. But it was me. It was my inner self. And I didn't even recognize that it was me. Okay, another thing that people do who better really understand themselves, they have self-directed lives, is they resist enculturation. This is today's culture, American pop culture, the Star magazine, American Zeitgeist 2007, mind you, celebrity-soaked, materialistic, hyper-competitive, youth-obsessed, coarse, resilient, also technological, it's not all bad, American pop culture. But look at how it changes. Here's American Zeitgeist 2009. Economically anxious, financially withdrawn, politically hopeful maybe, at least those who are supportive anyway of Barack Obama, we're still celebrity-soaked, youth-obsessed, coarse, resilient, and technological. But it shows you how you shouldn't be wedded to the current zeitgeist. People who are very healthy, Maslow's definition, are people of a century. They're people of the planet. They are not people of a country or a time or a decade. Close your eyes. The independent, the autonomous, are not dependent for their main satisfactions on the real world or other people or culture or means to ends or in general on extrinsic satisfactions. Rather, they're dependent for their own development and continued growth on their own potentialities and latent resources. This independence of environment means a relative stability in the face of hard knocks, blows, deprivations, frustrations, and the like. A relative serenity in the midst of circumstances that would drive other people to suicide. They have been described as self-contained. You know, when I say there's 19 traits of super healthy, one of the ones people always jump forward with is resilient. Well, this is resilience. And the reason they are is because they are self-directed. They are fully developed human beings internally. So this is deeper than resilience. Resilience is a way of describing it. It's an adjective, not a noun, really. All right, quickly. The autonomous work within a framework of values that are broad, not petty, universal, not local, in terms of a century rather than a moment. They are members at large of the human species. Think of Albert Einstein. He had 3 passports. Stop. We're going to talk about one person more, and then if anyone wants to stick around, because we'll be out of time, we're going to talk about Andrew Weil. How many people know who Andrew Weil is? Most of you. Harvard-trained, Philadelphia-raised, East Coast, traditional guy, who then went off and studied indigenous American tribes and all of the medicines they had and all the drugs they used. He thinks it's his job to be controversial. He thinks it's his job to be open to these alternative, holistic forms of medicine. He's classic in terms of someone who's willing to shoulder responsibility. He has empathy for mankind. He resists the culture. He tells people to turn their televisions off at least for a week once a year. Turn all the media off. This is what he's done in his life. Well, this is just a voiceover. Here's his Harvard education. Here he is in Central America learning about botany. He was one of 3 botany undergrads at Harvard. Now, to give you an idea of how far this goes, Maslow said that these people often feel like aliens on the planet because they are so detached from the culture. They're not driven by it. They may look like you and me, and they may wear a coat and tie or dresses and whatnot and try and conform just to make things easier. But if something's important, they will stand apart. They're often considered eccentric. Lincoln, you know, was considered this ridiculous dresser and an odd character and this country bumpkin. And, of course, he was simply standing apart from his culture, standing way above it. So I asked Andrew Weil up in his treehouse on his Tucson ranch about spirituality. And this is what he had to say.
My deepest feeling is that there is, you know, that maybe in any life, there is a feeling of something missing, which has to do with our separation from whatever, separation from the divine or separation from something higher.
Let me ask you a spiritual question.
Yeah.
Do you feel like there is an eternal world and you are an eternal being currently stuck on planet Earth,
Yeah. Temporal,
time-bound?
Yeah. I do. I mean, if I let myself go, and I mean, one of my fantasies is that the spaceship lands and they come out and say, oh, thank God, at last we found you. We've been looking all over. You know, a horrible mistake was made. You were supposed to go to the good planet.
So you see now, when I would interview these people, there's Maslow. Right from this gentleman's mouth. Now, autonomy tips. Encourage others, especially children. Pay attention to your daydreams. Turn off all communication devices in the evening. This is from Stephen Covey. At 7 p.m. or whatever time you're going to sit down with your family, those text messages and phone calls, they're urgent, but they're not important. And they're probably not even urgent. Take holidays from the news media. Tape television programs. Skip the commercials. Resist marketers' language. It's bubbly water, not sparkling. And escape, most of all, to nature. I'm going to stop there because we're out of time. But I'm happy to take any questions if anyone's interested in asking them, and I appreciate your being here.
Let's put our hands together. So we've been listening to Donald Vandermark talk to us about these many qualities that make for good among the great. And I guess I would be curious, and of course all this is all fascinating stuff, and it's too bad we don't have more time to go into it. So you shared with us kind of the top 3 or your favorite 3, whatever. Just taking a quick look at the remaining 16, what's your favorite among those, if you would, and give us just a hint of the other that you like the most or you think is important among the 16?
I like all of them. I mean, in different times of the day and at different times in my decision-making, one or another one will be more important to me. I'm just getting all the way back. Maslow had one called the democratic character structure, which is a little opaque at first. What he meant is, and you all know people like this, they don't see the superficialities. They don't see a person's age, their race, their sex. They treat children with much more respect than the rest of us do. Frederick Douglass, the great black leader in the time of the Civil War, said that Abraham Lincoln, after a meeting with him, was the first person he had met who treated him as if there was no difference in race. He wrote about it. This is a classic example of these individuals not putting people on pedestals and not treating those of lesser standing in society rudely or with less respect. So it's a wonderful attribute, and it's a subtle one. It's one you wouldn't think of. But I know a lot of people like that.
I'm sure there are some other questions here in the audience, but if I may, I'll just follow on with another quick one. When you and I were talking as we were going to get this program going, we were wrestling with the title, I remember, and, you know, great and good, where and would be underlined, and tips from the most successful people, and tonight we're talking about good among the great. Share a little bit what's going on in your mind when you talk about these are great, successful people, but yet there's this good quality as well. What characterize your great and good thing if, a little bit, if you would.
We can name a lot of people who would we consider great. They may be great business people, but we don't particularly admire them for the way they've treated their the environment, or they've treated a spouse, that sort of thing. I'm focusing on this subset, a small subset among very high achievers. They're the ones who are very high achievers, but they are also people who have most of these traits, not all the time. This is an ongoing process. You don't sort of get to some level and then you're this wonderful person with all these traits. It's an ongoing process of whether or not you are going to be as capable, as empathic as you should be. As I think more about this, I'm trying to find a way to deliver it to people like you who are interested. I feel as if I'm a messenger of sorts. And so I'm constantly turning this over and over in my mind, and I'm being told by the publishing world to not so much simplify it, but to distill it. So I have a hard time doing that, because I like all of these. An unhostile sense of humor is one, that if you think about it, so much of our humor is mean or cruel. I still indulge in it. I have to confess. And these people don't do it. My favorite people, their humor is based on puns, and it's more turned on themselves, and it's more about irony. That may be as good an ending as we get.
Well, let's see if we've got anybody else with any questions. We can take a minute or two here. Anybody else have a question, a burning question we got to ask, please?
Hi, thank you so much for your comments, and they're very inspiring. So I've been told that successful people, they happen to be at the right place, the right time. Now, chance versus choice, can you comment which one weighs more? Possibly?
I don't think it's an either or, and I will tell you that all of these successful people, even the ones who lack a number of these traits, but particularly those who have more of them, they will argue that they have been lucky. Now, there's an argument that they make their own luck. These are very, very prepared people. So when opportunity presents itself, they're there and ready. I think about right now, just in financial circumstances, if you were careful and not indulging in great risk, not following the pack in terms of a bunch of dumb investments, not if you were resisting the culture and not buying another pair of alligator loafers, and you had a lot of cash built up, and last year when everything started falling apart, you had some money to invest in great assets when they were deeply discounted, they would argue maybe they were lucky. Maybe they are. I mean, maybe they make more of their own luck. There is an element of chance. When I say that you have a large element of control over your own destiny, that you are the protagonist in the story of your life, but you are also, to a certain degree, the author of your own life. It doesn't mean that there aren't things that buffet you. Disease, terrible accidents. There's all sorts of things that we have no control over. So life is a complicated mix of that. It's not either or.
I actually have a question about some traits you mentioned across the presentation. Some things that kind of popped out for me were about competition, mm-hmm. and basically making sure that that element seems to have an impact on being successful. But at the same time, I think it was item number 9 on the list of exceptional well-being traits, is ability to love. How do you think that actually helps in being successful, given the competitive nature of success?
I'm not an expert at love. That's the first thing I will tell you. Maslow will tell you that it is sustaining for them. And what's interesting about when he talks about love, he talks about a couple of different things. One is that these individuals use the word warily. They save their love for very few people. They consider it a very, very profound state of being with another. And they don't share it with too many. You cannot do that. There isn't enough time. The other thing he says when he talks about love is that the very, very healthy have resolved so many of the dichotomies that the rest of us get hung up on. Male, female. Who's in charge, who's not. They don't see things that way. So they have a few deep relationships that sustain them, and they don't need it, but they do have it. He said that all of these people are loving and lovable characters. And one reason is that they are not needy. So I'm afraid I can't tell you much more than that. It's not a subject I'm an expert on, but the best book I think to look at from Maslow that has at least several pages on it is a book called Motivation and Personality.
Donald, what final thought would you like to leave with us as we leave tonight to ponder your comments and think about these other 16 as well as the 3 that you reviewed? What would be the one big thing that you'd suggest we consider?
Well, one thing I know is that a discussion like this is intriguing, but it's not going to change your life. If I get to ever write this book, that might be more helpful because you can return to it. But what I know would help is to surround yourself with the people you admire. This is advice that Warren Buffett gives all of the college students when he goes to speak to them. And he says that a principal reason is not just that it will make you more successful, that their traits and attitudes and behaviors will rub off on you, but it will be more fun. So please, that's the best way to inculcate these traits in your own personality, in your own behavior, and that is to surround yourself with people you admire. Thank you.
So thank you, Donald Vandermeer. Let's put our hands together again, please. I want to thank you, Donald, for some tremendous insights, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.